Good morning. It's my pleasure to bring you the word today. And I've just come back from Egypt, so I thought it would be very timely if I talked a little bit about Egypt and the Bible. However, as God would have it, what I was originally planning on talking about, God changed. And so this is what I want to talk about this morning. And the title is called Don't Panic. And if you're old enough, you may remember the old classic comedy TV series from the BBC called Dad's Army. And one of the characters, who was named Lance Corporal Jack Jones, would at some stage in every episode run around shouting, "Don't panic, don't panic," while running around in a frantic state of panic. It seems to me that the current state of world affairs is causing an awful lot of people to not only fear what the future holds, but to also figuratively run around in a series of panic, shouting, "Don't panic." So today I want to look at the prophecy contained in Daniel chapter 11, verses 3 to 35. Now, of course, secular historians will tell us that this was written around 165 BC. And this is mainly because of how accurate the historical details are. And therefore, there is no evidence for this, but they consider that it must have been written as history. In other words, after the events had already taken place. From a traditional Christian and Jewish perspective, the understanding is that the book of Daniel was written near the end of his captivity in Babylon, between 536 and 530 BC. In other words, it was hundreds of years before the events even took place. And there is plenty of evidence to show that this is the case and that the secular scholars are wrong. But that's a sermon for another day. Now, when reading Daniel 11, you may well think that it's not really very inspirational. It is essentially a story of names without names, wars without heroes, alliances made that then fall, and rulers who rise only to fall again. And yet God calls this chapter the truth. So why would God give his people such a detailed preview of centuries of political chaos? I believe it's not so that they would anticipate and control history, but rather so that history would not control them. In essence, Daniel 11 teaches us how to live faithfully when we are not in power. We are caught between opposing forces we didn't choose, and we cannot fix the world, but must still be faithful in it. This chapter is not about prediction. It is about, no matter what, God is in control. So let's now look at the scriptures verse by verse and see how history is showing these to be fulfilled. Starting in verse 3, and this is about Alexander and the Hellenistic breakup. "Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills." At the close of the Old Testament, the Persian Empire ruled over Israel and Egypt. Then, of course, Alexander the Great came on the scene and he quickly conquered the Persian Empire. He conquered Israel on his way through to Egypt in 332 BC. Verse 4. "And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his prosperity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these." Alexander died at the age of 32. One of his wives had given birth to a baby boy, but they were killed, as was his half-brother. Therefore, he had no heirs, and his empire was therefore divided amongst his four generals. Verse 5. This is the rise of the king of the south. "Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority." In 323 BC, Ptolemy I became satrap, or in other words, the provincial governor of Egypt. He took the title of king and pharaoh and so founded the Ptolemaic dynasty. and therefore making Egypt the enduring king of the south. Now, one of his former allies, Seleucus I, became satrap of Babylon. However, he was attacked by one of the other generals, Antigonus I, in 316 BC. And so he fled to Egypt, where Ptolemy made him a general in his own army. Now, Antigonus was killed, and Seleucus regained control of all the territory that Antigonus had. Now, this was far bigger and greater than that of Ptolemy, and so was founded the Seleucid Empire, or the King of the North. So therefore, Egypt and Syria emerge as the two dominant successor kingdoms, with, of course, Israel stuck right between them in the middle. Daniel 11:6. This is about an Egyptian marriage and alliance. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now, we have jumped forward in time, and now the king of the south is actually Ptolemy II. And the king of the north is Antiochus II. And they fight what's known as the Second Syrian War between 260 and 250 BC. Now, they make a peace treaty, and that is sealed with a marriage. So Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, marries Antiochus II of Syria. Now, to do this, he had to divorce his wife Laodice. And this unsurprisingly proved to be not a good move on his part. Carrying on. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. Ptolemy II died in 246 BC. Antiochus took back Laodice, sending Berenice back home to Egypt. And Laodice poisoned Antiochus, murdered Berenice, her child, and all her attendants. And so therefore this secured for her son the throne as king of the north. Daniel 11:7-9. And from a branch from her roots one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. A branch from her roots shall arise. He shall prevail. Berenice's brother, Ptolemy III, takes the throne. In revenge, he invades Syria in 246 to 241 BC. So he captured the capital, Antioch, as well as Israel, and he executes Laodice. He also reclaimed the Egyptian idols that were previously taken by the Persian Empire. Now, this is one of Egypt's greatest military successes. However, in 242 BC, Seleucus II, the son of Antiochus and Laodice, struck back by invading Egypt. He failed and so returned to Syria, where he actually died in 225 BC after falling off his horse. Daniel 11:10-12. This is renewed wars. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overthrow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand, and when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. Seleucus III became king, and he reigned for 3 years before being murdered in 223 BC. So Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great, he started the Fourth Syrian War from 219 to 217 BC. Now at this stage, Ptolemy IV was king of the south. Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great, was the king of the north. And so he regained control of Israel and the lands right down to the border of Egypt at a place called Raphia. And Antiochus had 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 war elephants. Ptolemy IV had an army to match, and he won a major victory at Raphia in 217 BC. Now, a side note is that this is one of the first times when elephants came up against elephants in a battle. And the king of the north, well, he had African elephants. The king of the south, he had Indian elephants. And although having smaller elephants, he still won the battle. And so because he won this battle, Ptolemy IV took back control of Israel and right up through to southern Syria. He then made peace with Antiochus III and returned to Egypt. The problem was that because of the drain of manpower and the battles, Egypt was weakened internally, and Upper Egypt started to rebel. Daniel 11:13-16. This is where Egypt again loses control of Israel. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. In those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. Ptolemy IV died in 204 BC, and his infant son, Ptolemy V, takes the throne. Antiochus started the Fifth Syrian War between 202 and 195 BC. Egypt lost a major battle at Panias, which is now called Caesarea Philippi, and that was in 200 BC. So Antiochus III, he captured the Egyptian forces after besieging and starving them at a coastal city called Sidon. And therefore, Israel again passed permanently from his Egyptian control back to Syrian or Seleucid control. Daniel 11:17. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of woman to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or to be to his advantage. Antiochus III decided not to invade Egypt so as not to anger Rome. He therefore made a peace treaty with Ptolemy V and gave his daughter Cleopatra I in marriage. Now note, that's not the famous Cleopatra that we all know and love. She was Cleopatra VII. So back to the story. So anyway, he gave Cleopatra I in marriage because he intended to control Egypt through her. She was to be his puppet. However, Cleopatra was fiercely loyal to her husband and so sided with Egypt instead. And this totally frustrated and derailed her father's plans. Daniel 11:18 and 19 is the decline of both powers. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them. But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. So Antiochus III broke the treaty that he'd made and started attacking both Egyptian territory as well as Greek territory. He was defeated by Rome in 191 BC by a Roman commander called Lucius Cornelius Asiaticus. So Antonius therefore became a vassal state of Rome, who heavily taxed him. Now, in order to repay these taxes, he attempted to plunder a temple in Persia. However, he was stopped and killed by the local population in 187 BC. And Egypt also becomes increasingly unstable and also dependent upon Rome. Verse 20. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an extractor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. So Seleucus IV becomes king. And to pay these taxes that were owed to Rome, he ordered a general by the name of Heliodorus to seize wealth from the temple in Jerusalem. However, God intervenes, and the attempt fails, and Heliodorus returns back to Syria empty-handed. Heliodorus then poisons and kills Seleucus IV in 175 BC. Daniel 11:21-30. In this place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, Antiochus IV was the brother of Seleucus, and he assassinates Heliodorus plus the infant son of Seleucus IV. So he not only kills his brother, but he kills his nephew. And that clears the way for him to become king in 175 BC. Verse 22, armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. Antiochus IV invaded Egypt twice. He'd make treaties and then he'd break them just as it suited him. He gave wealth and gifts to all and sundry just in order to gain favor and order. Verse 25. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Ptolemy the sixth came to the throne, and the sixth Syrian war broke out. Antiochus captured Ptolemy VI and most of Egypt, all except the area around Alexandria. And so the younger brother, Ptolemy VIII, was declared king of the rest of Egypt. Verse 27. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. Now, Ptolemy VI and Antiochus made an alliance, which neither intended to keep. And so he was set up as king in the city of Memphis over Egypt. But of course, this alliance fell apart very quickly. The good news is that Ptolemy VI and Ptolemy VIII reconciled through their sister, Cleopatra II. And for a time, all three ruled Egypt jointly. Verse 28. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. So in the meantime, Antiochus returned to Syria in 169 BC. And of course, he decided that on his way that he would get the army to ransack Jerusalem and plunder the temple of all its riches. Verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Here we have it again. Antiochus again invaded Egypt and besieged Alexandria. In 168 BC, a Roman fleet commanded by a Roman envoy, Gaius Papilius Lanus, stopped Antiochus at Alexandria. And this is where the saying line in the sand comes from, because Linus drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus and ordered him to declare if he intended to submit to the Roman Senate. And of course he agreed to, which didn't go down well. And he was actually furious and took it out on Israel and the Jewish people by attacking Jerusalem again on the way back to Syria. He persecuted the Jews and he outlawed Judaism on pain of death. Daniel 11 to 35 is the aftermath of all of this. And now, though Egypt was no longer central, the consequences of its conflict with Syria spill into and through Israel. Verse 31, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. Now, of course, on his way back to Syria, and Antiochus was furious, and so he not only ransacked Jerusalem and the temple, but he also offered unclean sacrifices and set up a statue of Zeus in the temple. Now, Jesus makes reference to this abomination of desolation in both Matthew 24:15 and Mark 13:14. And so it is maybe seen that this prophecy has multiple fulfillments, and there is a future one that is yet to come. Verse 32, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. And when they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. Now, because of this sacrilege that Antiochus had done in the temple, this sparked the Maccabean revolt. And it was over many, many years, but eventually Israel secured its independence in approximately 110 BC. However, that wasn't to last, because Israel was again conquered by the Romans in 63 BC, thus setting up for the arrival of Christ. Now, we will stop there, because that's an awful lot. And so I just want to go over some takeaway lessons that we can learn from this. Because Daniel chapter 11, particularly verses 3 to 35, aligns with the Egyptian history with extraordinary precision. It describes named dynasties. It describes specific marriages, military campaigns, political betrayal, and of course Egypt's eventual and gradual decline. And this accuracy is one reason why Daniel 11 is considered to be the most historically detailed prophecy in the Bible. But why is this important today? What does it mean to us living in this day and age? Now, in light of world events currently happening in the Middle East, it's very easy to wonder just what is going on, to be afraid of how that might impact us or our children. And we may even try to bury our head in the sand and just ignore the situation. But in the words of the great theologian Karl Barth, we need to carry the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. In other words, be in the world, take note of what's happening, but interpret it through the eyes of Scripture. Now, there are a huge number of takeaways from these verses, and so I just want to go over quickly over a few of them. One, God is sovereign over history, not just spiritual things. God rules over politics, empires, wars, marriages, betrayals, and economic pressure. So it's not just church life or personal devotion. Daniel 11 is deliberately unspectacular. It's about kings, taxes, alliances, invasions, propaganda. Yet through all this, God says in effect, this is my story. And for us today, we can take heart because world events are not random. Power struggles do not escape God's governance. And God's purposes advance even through flawed pagan empires. Because we don't need to panic when global politics feel unstable. Faith is not denial of chaos. It's confidence that chaos is not ultimate. And second, God's people often live between empires. Israel in Daniel 11 is very rarely in control of its own destiny. They are caught in the middle, wedged between Israel and Syria. They are taxed, they are pressured, they are betrayed, they are attacked, sometimes cooperating, sometimes resisting. Now, God does not promise his people political dominance. He promises presence and faithfulness within that pressure. And for us today, we should not assume that political power equals God's favor. And faithfulness may look like endurance, wisdom, and courage rather than victory. Being caught in the middle is not abandonment by God. And this resonates strongly with Jesus' words. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. John 16:33. Third, compromise with power is always tempting and it is always dangerous. Throughout Daniel 11, alliances promise security. Marriages promise peace. Political deals promise stability. And yet every compromise fails. God is not expecting us to look for salvation through alliance or compromise. We need to remember that political systems are not saviors. In fact, they're generally only temporary and fleeting. And cultural acceptance is not the same as faithfulness. Moral compromise for the greater good eventually costs more than it gives. So this doesn't mean disengagement from the world or what's happening around us, but it does mean discernment and looking for what God is doing in the midst of the turmoil. Four, God sees tyrants clearly and limits them. Antiochus IV looked totally unstoppable for a time. He was militarily clever. He was religiously oppressive. He was brutal, particularly towards God's people. Yet Daniel does not glorify him. In fact, God calls him a contemptible person in Daniel 11:21. Now, evil may be loud, it may be successful, it may be frightening, but it is never ultimate. For us today, bear in mind that tyranny has an expiration date. God is not impressed by cruelty or strength, and all oppressors are accountable, even if they seem untouchable. Five, faithfulness matters even when outcomes are hidden. Daniel 11, verses 32 to 35, highlights those who know their God, those who resist, teach, and stand firm, those who suffer, not always seeing immediate victory. Because God values faithfulness over success. And so for us today, obedience is often not validated or even rewarded by immediate visible results. And suffering does not mean failure. Teaching and standing up for God's truth may cost more than it gains in the short term. 6. God's revelation is meant to produce wisdom, not speculation. Daniel 11 is extremely detailed. Yet God never tells Daniel or the nation of Israel, change the outcome, predict the dates, manipulate events. Instead, the effect is to underline and encourage, to give understanding, to give sobriety, to give endurance. And biblical prophecy is meant to stabilize character, not satisfy curiosity. And for us today, prophecy should make us humbler, not louder, not I told you so. Should make us more faithful, not more fearful, because it is a reminder that God is truly in control. It should make us more anchored, not more combative. And then finally, history is moving towards God's kingdom, not away from it. Daniel 11 ends, and the whole of Daniel confirms that earthly kingdoms will rise and fall. God's purposes will continue and will endure. And God's people are refined, not erased. Now, our Christian hope is not that history improves or changes for the better. It is that God reigns and that his kingdom outlasts every empire. So in conclusion, Daniel 11 does not teach us to decode the future. It teaches us to endure the present. So what does faithfulness look like today? We are to stay grounded in God's word when the world is unstable. We are to stay discerning through prayer when power might offer tempting shortcuts. We are to stay courageous when speaking truth is costly. And we are to stay hopeful when outcomes are unclear. Daniel 11 teaches Christians today that God rules history, limits evil, values faithfulness over power, and calls his people to endure wisely and courageously in a world that will never be fully safe. But it is never out of God's control. History is not spiraling out of control. It is moving towards God's ultimate purpose. And lastly, if you remember nothing else, remember this. We do not live by fear. We do not live by compromise. We live by faith. Thank you.